You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet here in my individual capacity, and we're now in week two of a government shutdown that promises to be unlike any other. The director of the Office of Personnel Management and Architect of Project 2025 has promised mass layoffs without regard for appropriations or law, and no end appears in sight as of this recording. Now, hanging out with me tonight is Harvey Ryshikoff, actually my favorite co-host ever. He's the former chair of Skolins and a guy who has worked in so many parts of the government. He's been through so many shutdowns. He probably knows more than anybody. And by the way, he's such a busy guy that there are times when he cannot be located by anyone anywhere. But our guest tonight is Max Steyer, president and CEO of the Partnership for Public Service. And they look very closely at how the government is staffed and what happens during shutdowns. And they have a great website, folks, if you want to check it out.
Thanks for joining us tonight, Max. Max and I have known each other for a long time. And I like to think that he's the embodiment of what public service is all about. And his career reflects that.
Harvey, it's a pleasure to be with you and with your colleagues.
Let's begin with some basic and fundamental facts. Can you explain what a shutdown is? And why we see these shutdowns usually in October?
I think I can, and I'll try to be as brief as possible. The federal government operates under a fiscal year that ends September 30th and is supposed to re-begin on October 1st. So that's why this is the magic moment. A shutdown occurs when Congress does not complete its job of actually getting through all of its appropriation bills, and there is a lapse in appropriations, either in this instance complete, or sometimes partial because they complete some of their appropriations bills. And ever since Attorney General Civiletti interpreted the Anti-Deficiency Act to require the government to shut down in the context of a lapse in appropriations, that is what we get. It is very important, though, for people to understand that we are speaking loosely. Our government is not actually shut down. It doesn't disappear. If it were taking a day off, we would notice it in a very, very different way. And this is an important distinction because language does not match reality. Three quarters of the federal government's budget is actually mandatory, meaning that it is not impacted in any way by this lapse of appropriation. In addition, activities that our government is funded through fees or multi-year appropriations, or sometimes, as in the context of, for example, a Smithsonian, money they have left over, that the activities can continue. And even within that important, but still relatively smaller slice of annual appropriations, the Civiletti interpretation requires government activity that is engaged with the preservation of life or property to continue as well. So that exception is extremely important and one that I'm sure we'll return to. But that also means that most of the things that the public would notice if they disappeared actually don't disappear. It also means that federal employees are required to do them without getting their paycheck. Even though they will eventually be paid because of a 2019 law, they're not receiving it in real time. So last point I'll make on this, the only workforce in our country that I'm aware of that is required to work without getting paid, not a good situation.
You touched on this, Max, but between mandatory and discretionary sides of the budget, what are some of the discretionary sides of the budget?
I'll do the other side since it's a little easier. The entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid are all mandatory. On the discretionary side, it covers a pretty large, set of activities. Most of the things that the federal agencies do are annual appropriations. There are exceptions like the Patent and Trademark Office, which ultimately gets its support through fees from, patent filers, et cetera. But it encompasses a lot. Therefore, that issue, again, about what is considered accepted, what is connected to the preservation of life or property, becomes extremely important.
So one of the issues is that the last time we passed a balanced budget was, I think, 2001 with Bill Clinton in office. I was with that administration, so I take some credit for that because I watched my pennies when it came to expenditures. But usually what happens is, there's a continuing resolution. And we've had series of those in this period of time. What is your take on how a continuing resolution works? And that's how these things usually end. And what is your sense of them?
Balanced budget is important. But in this context, I would say even more important was 1996, which I think is the last time Congress passed all of its appropriation bills on time. Continuing resolution is the lesser of two evils, government shutdown being by far the more extreme problem. But the answer to lapses of appropriations in the past have largely been this notion of a continuing resolution where Congress kicks the can and there's an agreement that we haven't done our appropriations bill. So we will find a way to keep things open, which is something that makes a lot of sense. And the way they've done it is by passing legislation that effectively keeps government moving forward under the exact terms as it was under the last appropriations. And it's not a very strong management approach for a variety of reasons, including the fact that they're short term. By definition, they're not going to be as long as the year-long appropriations that would ordinarily be the course. It means that, therefore, agencies don't have the same field of view, length of view, to be able to manage towards. Typically, they come with a lot of restrictions. Your ability to end programs or start new programs are diminished. And so they have unfortunately become often the norm, even though they limit effective management. This is one of the things that a lot of people talk about. We should run government like a business. There is not a single business in our country that would be in business if they operated with continuing resolutions and shutdowns. So the constraints are extraordinary that civil servants are operating under to manage the delivery of the services they do already. Their hands are tied behind their back and their feet are tied together. You know, add many other constraints and you get the picture.
Alisa, you may want to jump in with your question now.
You know, there was a change in how things were managed that really occurred under Ben Civiletti. And it had to do with this concept of essential personnel, which we see right now. How did that affect sort of this pattern or this dance that we're into now that seems to repeat every time the majority wants something?
So I think there are two big changes that took place. One of them is the one you flagged, and that is the interpretation of the Anti-Deficiency Act that now requires government operations, with the exceptions that I mentioned earlier, to shut down when there's a lapse in appropriations. And that was not the view of the law prior to Civiletti's interpretation. The second is the politicization of the budgetary process itself. That's why this becomes a real problem, because the budgetary process has become a vehicle for the statement of policy resolutions that aren't being resolved in other contexts. So it's seen as a point of high leverage. That process is something that has accelerated over time. You can perceive it in many other aspects of our governance, but it has infected the budgetary process in a way that means that you do not have clean appropriations. This is one of the points in which especially a minority can state its objections to things that they don't like that they have not found other points of leverage to accomplish. And that has really gummed up the works in a very big way. In some sense, similar to the debt ceiling, you know, there are a few of these must-pass votes that have become the primary way for one side or the other to force an issue that they have not been able to achieve elsewhere.
To that point, polls that are taken shortly after these shutdowns show a real diminished public opinion of the institution of Congress, period. To the extent that this year, just 5 days ago, Congress overall was hovering at 26% approval rating, which is remarkable. And that's not just one or two polls. What do you think is the impact of these shutdowns on the office of Congress?
So I think this is part and parcel of why, if you ask the American public and we have what they think about our federal government, the question they're answering is, what do they think about bickering politicians in Washington? That is the image that they have when you say federal government. They don't actually think about civil servants. That's something that we want to change, because most Americans are unaware that 80% of the people who are actually doing the work of government live outside of Washington, D.C. They're their neighbors, they're the air traffic controller and smoke jumper and the food safety inspector. But these kinds of incidents reinforces this idea that the whole thing is broken and should just go away. And one of the reasons why I highlighted the fact that this is not really a government shutdown, there are aspects of government that are interrupted. What's important is that part of the messaging that the public has is, okay, the government shut down and we're still fine. My life still goes on. You know, maybe I don't get the trash cans emptied at the national park. I can deal with that. That is not really, you know, what's at play here. And they think it's all broken because they watch politicians not get their primary responsibility done and not have any accountability for it. And that's a big problem. And instead, there's a typically an effort to, you know, reframe the blame for the civil servants. And you see that a little bit in terms of the language from this administration, you know, even around the out of office messages that they're putting up, you know, for federal employees. Very, very disturbing, and reinforces the point that you've made, which is it drives trust into the toilet.
Yes. One of the issues, of course, is our famous Hatch Act. And I think some of the banners are tiptoeing over that Hatch Act, sort of bright
not
red line.
Tiptoeing. They are
they've jumped over. They've jumped
yes.
over the red line. One of the issues, Max, is why many of us have such admiration for you, is that you founded the Partnership for Public Service. So really to help bring the best and most qualified people into government service without regard for partisan politics, and with a view of providing a better government for the American people, which has been your mission. How do you see this affecting and playing out the ability to attract people to government when they realize if they're not, quote, essential or not part of the discretionary funding, that they will be able, as you said, to have to work, not be paid, or have the contracts put on hold?
So, Hari, I think it's a real problem that you're highlighting here. I will just pivot a second, though, to something that I think is even more important and something that I admire the ABA for having done, which is to have put out a statement in defense of the rule of law. And you're pointing out that the Hatch Act is in jeopardy, I would say has been eradicated by the behaviors we've seen so far, not just by the behaviors, but by the removal of the institutional elements of our government that are intended to enforce it. So the fact that the head of the Office of Special Counsel is no longer an independent actor in any way is a huge problem. But I think this point about the rule of law is truly fundamental and even more important in thinking about the nature of the talent that either might want to come into government or want to stay in government. You know, one of the extraordinary opportunities that I've had and that you've had and that Alyssa's had is to be able to work on behalf of the American people. And that's the proposition that public service has, that you are there for something greater than yourself and you're there for our country. And we're watching a very different vision of our government being implemented right now. And this is not a partisan statement, because for 140 years, that notion that our government is there for the public good has been accepted by Republican and Democratic leaders without question, and for good reason, because we saw what occurred otherwise with, you know, the spoils system of the 19th century. But this administration is actually affirmatively and explicitly trying to bring us back to that different model. And I think that will have way more impact on our ability to have the right kind of talent in our government, talent that is there for their expertise and that is there again. Capacity, competence, and character are the things that we should want, not loyalty. And that's being turned on its head.
Part of the question that I have on that, Max, is that we're talking about sort of the lack of trust again in essential institutions that's definitely potentially created when these shutdowns occur. But there are also risks to the American people themselves presented because of these shutdowns. Do you want to talk a little bit about what some of those risks are, what they look like, and why the average person ought to take them seriously?
Yes, and thank you for that. And this is a little complicated message because I'm trying to say two things, one of which is the government's not gone away. And it's important to understand that distinction because we're going to see a lot of things that happen that are actually good for us that government is continuing to do. And yet it is diminished in very important ways, which is the point that you're raising right now. Most of the impacts that represent that diminishment of capability are long-term ones. So I saw a wonderful piece recently about how flight delays are actually caused by shutdowns. Why? You know, what functions do get disrupted? The recruiting of air traffic controllers, the training of air traffic controllers. These are long-term processes that can't happen when you have government shutdowns. And therefore, the tail, the impact, happens well past the time of the shutdown itself and is typically not connected to it. So inspections of drug manufacturers, of food safety, all those things are getting interrupted. So what will we see? We'll see more food poisoning. We'll see more examples of the things that we don't want in our society happening, because those longer term investments are not occurring. The longer this drags on, the more it will also diminish the capability of the people who are being forced to work without paychecks. So we saw that the last time in the first Trump administration, the last longest shutdown we had, 35 days in which, you know, people were calling in sick, air traffic controllers and TSA security officers. It is incredibly difficult for the public servants who are, again, forced to work without pay, who have also just experienced a very difficult 9 months where they've been purposefully traumatized, in the words of the leadership of the administration today. So I think those are the experiences that the American people will have over time. They should not diminish the fact that this is a bad thing just because it may not interrupt every aspect of their life in an overt way. It is happening, and it is bad, and it's wasteful.
One of the concerns, too, is that there's this distinction between so-called essential workers who must stay on the job. And I think what this does is, by implication, suggests that other people who do very important work, let's say something in the Library of Congress, something in the archives, that somehow they're not essential. And statements have been made that, you know, maybe some of these people should just be let go. I'm not sure what you might think about that concept, that dichotomy between so-called essential and not essential in a democracy like this one, or a country as developed as this one is.
Yes. And I think your point, again, is incredibly important. Just a point of clarification, the language should actually be accepted and not accepted. And so there's a tendency to use, it's just as you suggested, language that carries with it freight that is not helpful, essential and not essential. You're right that that kind of dichotomy is deeply problematic, because the people who are forced to work without pay do have jobs, or should have jobs, that are more directly connected to the immediacy of a threat to a life or property. But all the folks, even those that are forced to stay home despite the fact that they want to go to work and also not get a paycheck, those people are actually deeply important to the longer term and broader venture that represents our federal government. If they were not actually essential, then, you know, there is a legitimate question to review and think about what functions we want to continue. But they are typically the people who are often in the back office. Your HR professional, you may not think is essential today, but the reality is that without that recruiting of that next generation of air traffic controllers, we're in deep trouble. Huge swaths of the federal government, almost half of it, is told to stay home, is not accepted. They're still essential, but their work is not, again, immediately connected to the preservation of life or property. And in this administration, the screen that they're using is to say, is it connected to this president's priorities, as opposed to the law and the legal priorities that our government should be pursuing? And that distinction is also quite important. We have, as you noted, an administration that is seeing this as an opportunity to remove people that, frankly, you should not be putting on the chopping block for the reasons that are being offered, or to make messaging points, as we cited earlier, about, you know, the partisan nature of this fight. So, you know, this is a long-winded answer to say, you're right. That distinction is one that also creates internal conflict. I was talking to an agency head this past weekend who was describing, after the shutdown was over, how difficult it was for those two camps to reintegrate, because one group, you know, felt like they had to work and the other group did not. And the other group felt like we were not valued enough. And that's not a good dynamic either. The bottom line is everyone loses in this process, and no one loses more than the civil servants. They are both first responders and victims. Not a good combination to be in.
I think if the numbers are correct, and I welcome correction from you, Max, but potentially 1 million government workers could be let go. And I wonder what the economic implications of that would be, including things like impact on the jobs numbers and the economy.
We don't really know how many employees are actually not accepted, so furloughed and told they cannot work. And we don't really know yet what this administration is going to do. They have threatened to fire many of those people that are furloughed. But the truth is, we've already seen extraordinary and unprecedented damage to the federal workforce. So we run a harms tracker at the partnership. We count over 200,000 federal employees that have either been fired or constructively fired. It is worth recalling that we have about 2.3 million, or we did, federal employees. And that's the same size as it was in the 1960s, despite the fact that so many functions of our government have actually increased. And that's an absolute number. That's not a relative number. These are huge, huge, huge numbers. And your question is, what impact will this have? And the answer is, our government could not function in today's world, especially because there's not any strategy or planning behind the firing. It really is fire, 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 not ready, aim, fire. And therefore, even if there were, you know, smart ways to reduce the workforce, and there probably are, the fact is that contractors would be probably a better source of identification of waste. But there's no doubt that there's ways to reshape the workforce to make it better. That is not what is occurring here. But if you saw scaled additional firings, what it will mean is that our government will be unable to perform its core and vital functions. It's already true, this is national security, that we are more at risk for a 9/11 type incident than we were before 9/11. We are less prepared to deal with a natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina than we were before Hurricane Katrina. And we are less prepared to deal with a pandemic than we were before this last pandemic. And it is all because of diminution of the federal capacity, the workforce, to meet the challenges of the day, and a leadership group that doesn't respect expertise or data or the rule of law.
But the big question is, how do we get away from this lack of civility and dialogue in the political arena? And are you going to put forward or think about specific legislation that might change this pattern of government shutdowns and the dialogue that we're having?
There have been some, I think, good efforts at thinking about ways to incentivize better behavior amongst the political leaders so that there is actually some accountability and consequence for failing to do their core functions, like pass appropriations on time. And they include that if anyone's not going to get paid, it should be those folks. They shouldn't be paid to take flights back to their district if they haven't actually completed the work that they're supposed to do. You know, there's obviously limits to how much you can force people to do their jobs, but there's some starts that I think would be meaningful. I think your civility point is important. I do think we need, as a society, to find the similarities more than the differences and to figure out a way to build to better. And one of the things that I think, you know, we are focused at the partnership is thinking about how actually you do DOGE right. Like, how do you make our government a better place? The concept is right. The execution was horrible, but we have opportunities to actually improve our government's performance. I come back, though, to something that I think is fundamental to the ABA and that you've already stood on, and that is none of this works without the rule of law. Like, none of this can happen if we don't have a fundamental respect for our constitutional system and for the rule of law. And, you know, I come back to Ben Franklin's statement, which is we hang together, we hang separately. I think one of the things that we really do need to see is leaders across the board. My wife says a fallen lawyer. As a lawyer, I think lawyers have a special role here to stand up for the rule of law. It was dismaying to me to see, you know, law firms do things that they shouldn't have done. And some law firms stand up for doing the right thing. We need more people to stand up. I don't think this gets solved through legislation on the civility front. I think ultimately it's the American public that needs to understand that this is bad for them. And there's actually a better way. Part of that will come from getting good information out to people. I do think that that is vital. I trust the American public, given the right information, the correct information, true information, data, that they're going to make the right choices. And I think we're in an environment where that is harder and harder to come by. So I appreciate this opportunity to have this conversation with you, at least to share my views and hopefully move the ball forward in that way.
Thank you, Max. And all I can say is, keep up the great work that you've done in the partnership, and you're one of the ray of sunshines in this dialogue.
You're kind to say that. I appreciate this conversation. You and I have a lot of history. I'm hopeful. As one of my heroes said, like, hopelessness is the enemy of justice. I believe in our system. I believe in our Constitution. I believe in our democracy. And I believe we all have a role to make a better future for all of us. So if we do that, then we're going to be just fine.
Thanks, Max. And we will make available in the notes a hyperlink to Max's website, where they also have some resources. There's a lot of information there that you can look at. And we really appreciate you coming in the midst of all of this when you're in very high demand.
Thank you very much.
And we want to make sure that you're all aware of our upcoming National Security Law CLE conference on November 13th and 14th. Which is in DC this year. It's our 35th year. Our discussions this year will focus on technology, national security, and the law, and keeping pace with innovation. This is a don't miss event. We will hyperlink to the website for registration, agenda, and lots of other information. And we hope to see you there because it's fun. We want to thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to share this episode with a friend. Make sure you subscribe, if you can, to your listening app of choice. That assists us greatly. Just remember, unity is a key feature of our national security. Even when we can't agree on every issue, we can agree to listen to one another. We remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than any other, and that's a good thing and should stay that way. The writer, producer, and host of NSLT is me, Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and co-producer is Francis Burkham. Our program manager is Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. And my co-producer is also Holly McMahon, who is ever and always amazing. And we're forever grateful to the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security who pursue the good in the interest of national security without regard for politics or party, including Mr. Ryshikov. And we'll see you next week for a return to our series on AI's thirst for energy and the national security implications of the AI boom, which we hope doesn't also go bust. Talk to you then.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.